best if somebody had something to ask or to remark on the last meeting. And I would be very grateful if...
As I came first to this talk, the way in which it was, I was thinking that you were going to talk about the Calvinistic point of view on economics. You know, the way of thrift and so forth, and how we were supposed to, basis of a capital.
Max Weber's thesis.
Yes, exactly.
So why should I say that? No. It's a bigger thing.
Yeah.
It's much bigger.
Yes.
It's really all mankind involved. As you now see very clearly from any headline in the papers, that we have to face reality of the whole globe. So it isn't done with any merely sentential doctrine of Mr. Calvin. Calvin had the economy in a very profound sense, by the way, the word. Mr. Max Weber doesn't mention this. Calvin speaks of the economy inside God. There is in his... Well, there's a relationship of the Trinity, you see, there is an economy that is certain purposes where are achieved through the Son and others through the Spirit and others through the Father. And he calls this, Calvin does in his theology, this the economy within God. That's a very profound remark. But he's richer than the modern interpreters make him. Calvin was really a very great man. And they don't believe this, you see, they think they are the great men. I don't believe them. And he had this great wisdom. The greatest thing that Calvin used to say in his writings, and which is never mentioned, is that he would not, by mere curiosity of his antagonists, be led beyond the wall, so to speak, which is open to men. He will not speculate. He would try to know what can be known, but his opponents in the 16th century we are the same as the same people who today say that intellectual curiosity is a virtue. Now, I don't believe that, you see. And although it's on a campus of this caliber here, it's always repeated, but mere curiosity, go to the movies if you are curious. But curiosity leads you nowhere. Without love, without sympathy, without being rooted in the world of which we try to get cognizance, you cannot know anything. By curiosity, knowledge is corrupted, and perverted. I mean, all the fashions today of the perverts, you see, is simply, in every generation, of course, there is curiosity, overboring. A child can be curious, you see, but you also must admit that a child, when you talk to her, when it is curious about love, doesn't know what love is. And you can be curious as long as you have not reached maturity and ripeness, you see. Let a child be curious. But when the father explains, or the mother usually does in this country, when the mother explains something to the child, she must accept the fact that the child cannot understand it. You will find, for example, that this famous sexual enlightenment, when you give it to a 9-year-old child, is perfectly worthless. I mean, they don't understand. You can say what you like there, you see. It doesn't make any difference. Something has to be said to them, I agree, you see. But what has to be said to them is perfectly indifferent, because they forget it right away. And that's my experience with all this enlightenment for children, you see, or curious people. Fairy tales, of course, also satisfy the curiosity of the poor about the rich, about the king and the princes, you see. Just if you look at the fairy tale, you know that the poor men, the king, had to be much soberer in governing the country, you see, not as in the fairy tale. So, the economy of reality, you see, is really limited to serious business. And as I can only repeat my conviction, my experience in life, I have been very curious. But this can go with great reverence. I mean, you can be curious about things where you can be curious. I mean, I would like to know how an airplane functions. This may call it curiosity, you see. But to be curious about God, that's impossible. And to be curious about your parents is impossible. If you are curious about your parents, you have lost your parents. So this is a great handicap today when we discuss things, because these two levels, I call them play and seriousness. Intellectual curiosity belongs to this play-like attitude, which we all have to apply because life is too serious, so to speak. We need this relaxation. And television, you can be curious, I mean, it doesn't matter. But this is not serious. And you never rely on any information gotten by curiosity, you see. You see, this is very different. Vietnam, you cannot cope with from the Encyclopedia Britannica. This doesn't help you. So many square miles, so many people, there and there, nothing said about its significance as of this moment. So, this is just one thing. I'm quite glad that you brought this out, because our whole academic world is under this blight of curiosity. It's not enough. It may be a beginning, but the teacher who gets a student to ask him a question from curiosity has immediately to inject a note of danger, you see. High voltage. Or the child will not learn the difference between serious and play. And I don't have to tell you, in California, I mean, that the greatest temptation of modern men is curiosity. The lack of balance between what is serious and what is play. And some people, you see, it seems to me that these kidnappers, both in the last week, you see, didn't know what they were doing because they didn't know the distinction between play and seriousness. And there's capital punishment on a kidnapping case. I'm sure these people who were now arrested, you see, didn't know. Otherwise, their surrender is quite unbelievable. They had never thought it out. Now, this has to do with the economy in this sense, that the economy of salvation and the salvation of economics must have to do something with our power to distinguish serious things and leisure things, or things of leisure time that are not serious. If you take this town of Santa Barbara or Goleta and you ask on what does it live, you see, you will have to find out what is serious and what is luxury. You see, how you can go without for a year. And you have to strip the community first of these superfluous things, or these supernumerary things, these play-like things. And our whole poverty program today, the Youth Corps, you see, and also the camps, the Peace Corps abroad, is exposed, or is, so to speak, in this predicament to make the participants feel that it is serious and not play. A Peace Corps girl that goes out of Cambodia, you see, because it's so cheerful, interesting, you see, and will spoil the whole thing. She must be serious. And how poor Mr. Sergeant Shriver gets all his people to be serious, I do not know. It must be very difficult. And this the same is now true with the poverty program, you see. It is very difficult to get a 16 or 18-year, 20-year-old boy in this program to understand that this means business. And because they have never known the difference between business and play. And I think many of our areas of blight come from this fact that the slums are occupied by people who were not taught this distinction between, for example, dropping out of school, you see, can be play and can be serious. With most of the children, it is just, they don't know how serious it is to drop out. If you could inject this note of seriousness, we would be better off. I have given much thought to this, just this problem of the Peace Corps in at home and abroad, and I think the temptation has been to sell it to the members of this as game, as play, as sport, you see. And I've always objected to this, because I think this cannot be cured afterwards. Once you have injected this note of play, I have not found that you can make the transition. Once the child, the member, the Youth Corps soldier, so to speak, is allowed to think that's good, that's play, that's, you see, interesting, it's charming, it's good fun, as they say, you see, then the honor is gone. I mean, to go to Vietnam is not fun for a soldier, and it shouldn't be fun for a Peace Corps man to go to Cambodia. or the whole piece got better close shop, you see. So you have brought up here a problem which is perhaps the most serious of urbanization. In an urban, the urbanized society, the line between seriousness and fun, you see, is obliterated. On a farm, everybody knows how serious it is to milk the cows. This is the one serious thing, and you have to collect the eggs. That's serious, and cannot be, even if the farmer is sick and his wife is sick, that boy of 8 has to go out and collect the eggs. That's serious, and it cannot be omitted. And it is not true that we advance, you must know this, the man has been a principal of a school, God be merciful to his soul, but the temptation is to make it all plain. And so that the children shall not know that this they are in earnest. I don't believe in this. What is important is to make it appear the distinction between seriousness and game. I'm all for playing, you see, but then it has to be played. And you cannot play unless there's also another region of your soul in which you're very serious indeed, or which you know that your parents are serious. That's usually the first. The way in which it begins. And of course, this is the whole question of the economy. I had a very interesting letter from a friend in Holland. I may bring this in because it has immediately to do with the modern economy of salvation and the fact that a worker can be saved and an employee cannot be saved easily in a modern office. Which is why it is more difficult for an office worker to treat his economics rightly than compared to a worker who is working on a steel furnace. This friend of mine works on a computer, and he wrote to me that it was still quite unexplored, the fact that all the workers in his steel furnace, the biggest and only steel furnace, as a matter of fact, in Holland. And it's a big works and 20,000 people working there. And he says, my fellow workers in front of the furnace, they are serious. They risk their health. When they come home, they must play. We here at the computer, we play. When I come home, I must be serious. You must create something which is serious for my leisure time, because this is not serious. No risk, you see, of life and limb involved, and this is all a game. That's why it is so terrible, this computer business, you see. So, I hope I go through life without having destroyed anyone. It always itches me to do it. Because it forces people to live a jocose life. That's not serious for a human being to work on a computer. And he means it, by the way. Last letter is he's leaving. Now, since I have used these very highfalutin terms, the salvation of economics and the economics of salvation, I must tell you that I'm very concerned with the impotence of modern men to discriminate between seriousness and play. And you see it in our treatment of the military, of the war problem. I mean, these students in Berkeley who march, I respect their opinion, but they have never thought that this might be very serious, their marching. That is not a good joke. Most of them say it's great fun. It's not a good reason to demonstrate because it's good fun. And because you're good fellows, I mean, of course, any 2,000 people who march together have a wonderful time, you see. But that's a very small time compared to the great moment during which they march. And this day again, you have the feeling, I at least have it, that 1999 of these demonstrators have never learned to distinguish between seriousness and fun. And of course, it is very difficult to talk at all about this because in this country, the sports are very serious. Even Mr. Patterson is taken seriously. And I can't. I'm spoiled for this, you see. Football and baseball, I cannot take it seriously. And therefore, it is, I understand that I am retarded in my development. But any country will perish where, the, where, as in Rome, you see, where the games are more important than death and truth. And the prognostication is very poor for any country in which the games carry the day. Anything I should grant him, pardon me. May I ask one other question?
Yes, may I ask, in Europe, do you know if so much emphasis is placed upon that word leisure as we do here? Because, for instance, New Horizons, just to pick anything, where you have leisure time for people over, say, 45 or 50. And just in your general life, everything that we see is pointed toward us as for leisure. Your leisure is made the whole thing. Now, in Europe, is that taking place too?
Yes, America is contagious.
Yes, that's what we said. I didn't.
You are right. I mean, but there is already a deep feeling.
We're bombarded with this. I mean, we're just so that. Well, how many? When did it start? Around the before the First World War, that this change took place in which the parents became children, and that sort of thing. Because there was a difference.
Yes, at the next meeting, I'll try to say more about this. You're absolutely right. It is, I think, the very bad conscience of the industry, and that by simply shortening the working hour, they buy off this drudgery or this meaningless existence. I think that is no solution. I have a little experience on this. I had to give a broadcast, and I went to the station and welcome, and I tried to explain exactly your problem. You see that the worker was not helped the 3 days off, Saturday and Sunday. In Germany, for example, they simply work twice. They have a second job. I don't know how far this is done here too, because they can't stand it, the leisure, you see. And so I propose that every 6 years there should be a sabbatical year for the worker in which he could learn something, a new trade, or perfect himself in his old trade. And the funny result of this was that the technician who handled the machinery of my broadcast came up to me right after it and said, "It's wonderful. I don't know what to do with my Saturdays and Sundays. If you only could compound them all, you see, into 1 year, how wonderful this would be." So this man, you see, was himself a victim of this system and felt that there should be a way out. You should really compress this time again to a unity. So I think this is simply, most stupidities are done, as you know, from bad conscience. I mean, conscience, money, and so on. You know what it does. It's just wasted. And the unions, you see, being organized on the lowest common denominator, because they want to have everybody in it, they had no way out. They could not start with the elite and say, "You want to have a sabbatical and trained worker wouldn't be stimulated or attracted by such a program." So I think we have now, after some security has been given to all, we may be able now to be more specific, you see, and give people what they really want. This is today the problem, I mean, see, this. Communism and capitalism are no longer issues. You see, they are just over with. The Russians are fed up with communism, and we are fed up with, I don't know. But I mean, it's not of any. These problems are no longer antagonistic. You see, I have found that my whole life I have stood between the fronts. I have always been rejected by the old order and by the new order, so-called new order. Because I know that these people do not say what they really feel and think. It's all in the air to attract masses. You have to be very stupid to attract all the members of the Dutch society, and you have to be very stupid to attract all the members of the union. So both cannot speak the truth. It's impossible. This minority group, which always starts any new invention, any new order of them, you see, it can by through our modern mass media, you can't reach them. It's impossible to talk at the same time reason to 20 million people. Seems to me impossible. And we are not treated as reasonable people over the television. I have, for the first time in my life now at my motel, you see a television set. I'm sick. I've tried it twice. And I can't sleep afterwards because of the advertising that goes in between these things. Only idiots can do this. I'm not an idiot. And go on now, ask, is this satisfactory?
Yes.
So please, that's one point where you can really help yourself and others by insisting that the leisure problem is not for all the classes of our people the same, that for a worker who sweats, who may fall sick from cold and heat, the relation of work and leisure is still genuine. For an employee in the office, it is not genuine, because what he is aching for is something serious where he couldn't put his teeth in, you see, when he comes home, because it isn't serious to do these formal things. I always wonder what a man is behind the desk at the post office does when he goes home after having sold stamps all day long.
He watches television.
Does he want it? He has television.
Yeah, but as he watches that's it for the most part, unfortunately.
You think you're...
Oh, yes. I mean, we're just inundated. When you talk with just pick out anyone, not on a campus, but you're getting just a small sample of that, and you see it's just moving in on them. So with more leisure time, he would look at more television. Unless there is going to be some type of program, and how does that start to lead people, because they are being led.
I have a good topic for the next time. But at first I would like to hear something on your mind. Yeah.
You talked about curiosity, and you said that there is a greater amount of it now than perhaps there was. I think curiosity is sort of a young person's trait more than an older person's trait. Eve was curious and she ate the apple, and had she been 20 years older than she was, she probably wouldn't have tried the apple. But why do you say that you can't be curious about God? What is this relationship of man to God? It's a very complicated thing, of course. But why can't you be curious about God? Why can't you ask questions?
Well, certainly, one fool can ask more questions than 100 wise men can answer. That's an old story. But as soon as somebody asks a curious question about God, the only behavior is not to answer. In a curious way, then the question is worth to be answered. If the child that and injustice has been done in the world, and the child says, how is it possible that the merciful God allows this to happen? You have to answer. But that's from a real fright, from a real shock this child has received. She suddenly sees that God is not so simply, you see, explained as a good uncle. It's serious. But the child must have been offended by something in the order of the world, you see, which it cannot understand. Then it is no longer a question of curiosity, but a painful search, you see, for better understanding. At this very moment you can enter on a conversation. Don't you see the difference? I have seen cases myself, we can't help everybody, one of us we have, where the only answer is, you are too young for this, or this is, don't be stupid. And I'm sorry that this isn't often said. There are questions that must not be answered. And the injustice lies in the fact that people try to answer what should not be answered.
Doctor, how then would you explain our relationship with God? Would that be based on more on love rather than on speculative theology, as you might call it?
Well, probably you have. You come around to the point I tried to make last time, is that theology is an attempt, maybe a desperate attempt, in the sense it has some significance, to put the image of God before us as though we could chart his course, as though, like a map of Africa, you can have a system of the divine. Unfortunately, at the same moment where you try to get God in focus, he no longer is there. In the Old Testament and in Old Egypt, the people had a very profound insight into the divine. They said, God is here in back of us. He leads us, he pushes us forward. The idea that God is made in your image so that you can see him like a human being or a tree is ridiculous and it's blasphemous. The one thing that God is not to be seen, when Moses in the desert, you see, stands there, God is only to be seen from in back. And the Bible says nobody can see him. All the attempts to see God, you see, have led all the nations of antiquity so much astray that Jesus had come to life because in his human figure, we are allowed to see the divine. It is a way out. That's why the Lord came down on earth. All the things of the incarnation, you see, are literally true. The meaning being that men cannot see the thousands of years. He cannot see the creative process of God Almighty, who is the Lord of the eons, the Lord of centuries. How can you see a century? How can you see thousand years? You see, before God, thousand years are as one day. So the Lord came down and in his 3 days, from Good Friday to Easter Sunday, he made visible in the sufferings of the human heart what we call the divinity, the creative power of weakness, of death. He became a child. He became a germ, so to speak. He became the seed of the church. He gave birth to the church. All these words are all literally true. And it is the only way in which God has become visible is in a human being. All the theologians, therefore, you see, pardon me for saying this, very frankly, are, I think, overstepping the limitations of human thinking. They are not allowed to do this. That's why I speak of theonomics. Why do we say theonomics? I know that God is present. And as in the, there's a wonderful monument in Chicago of the God of the Egyptians, who also were pious people. You mustn't think that they were godless or unreligious. And the great falcon, the imperial bird, you see, has his wings on the shoulders of the pharaoh. Many of you must have seen a copy of this. It's very famous. Mr. Breasted brought this to Chicago. It's the gem of the collection there. Horus, you see, has his wings around the shoulders and the neck of the pharaoh, and therefore he is inspired. This is literally true. Never think that God can be seen. He cannot be seen. We say honestly that he is invisible. Only most people, I mean, forfeit their privilege, so to speak, of being God's children. The child is left in front of the Old Testament. There are several places in the Old Testament where this is clearly expressed. I think God says to Abraham, go, I will go behind you. It must be in Genesis. You can find it in the Concordance and in the behind. This is quite important, you see. Early man has had the insight that what we speak of the divine because it cannot be seen. This is the reason why we know there's something in the world, you see, which doesn't fall under the category of chairs and walls and stones and trees, because it cannot be seen. Otherwise we wouldn't have to speak of the divine at all. Anything more? Well, I would make use of this to tell you something which I couldn't say in too much in the first lecture, but which I would like to round out now. Is there any more questions? You may have been surprised by my stress laid on this great New England divine, Jonathan Edwards. And yet he is the only man, I think, who has contributed something lastingly to organize our thinking through the times, and to be quite emphatic about the distinction between the times before Christ and the days after Christ. And the economy of salvation, of which Jonathan Edwards speaks, is based on the very simple assumption
that which I said last time. No, I've come down. I won't disappoint you.
And it's better not to write on, but to go on here. He says the incredible story of our knowledge of God consists in this simple fact that there are first 6,000 years, then there is one human life, the life of Christ. One generation, not even one whole generation, very short, half a generation, and then from then on history, as we know it, the first 1,000 years, you see, and the second 1,000 years, and now we hope even to reach the third millennium. That is to say, the whole theonomic approach to life tries to make you see the importance of time spans. Everything what we call modern, what we call scientific, what we call worldly, what we call secular, has to do with space, with things in space. And you all know that this the law of the relativity of Mr. Einstein, now the satellites which we use, all these things are based on men's secular power to subdivide space and to enlarge space. The distances which now we can fly are infinitely larger than anything covered before. 30,000 miles, you see, 50,000 miles, they mentioned, 100,000 miles. It is the achievement of the last 1,000 years that we have enlarged and made smaller the units of space, of things. And that's what we call scientific. Wherever science is at work, it decomposes units, you see, and synthesizes units. And this is all things in space, from bigger and bigger, from smaller and smaller. The electronics business, you see, is smaller and smaller. Bacteria, smaller and smaller. And on the other hand, this galaxy is no longer the limit, you see. They want to conquer Mars and Venus. The religious story of mankind is the opposite, or not the opposite, it's correlated perhaps to it, because it had to achieve for mortal man, who is like an ephemeral gnat, like a fly, goes and comes, put him safely into one huge eternity, an endless time. For you, it is no longer frightening to say that God is eternal. You sing it even, with emphasis. This had to be done, my gentlemen. Nobody in the days of Moses or Abraham or Adam knew anything of eternity. The greatness of Jonathan Edwards consists in this fact that he said, this enlarging of time, this being sure that I am not just as of this moment, that through my relatives, through my work, I can make a name for myself, or at least I can leave behind good works which will bear fruit long after I have lived. Everybody who has children, everybody who teaches, everybody who does anything in this world which he thinks is worthwhile, is in some way confident that it will bear fruit, that it will have effect, far beyond his own existence. And the less we can know about this effectiveness, the more efficacious Juru is. The people who are so vain that they have to build their monument in their own lifetime, you see, cannot expect that they have any effect. But the people who do not want to know what's going to happen to their good deeds, they are able to concentrate on the good deed and on the goodness of the deed so much that they really reach posterity, which is all new, gentlemen. And it is formally, if you have no carnal children of your own flesh and blood, you disappear. Because a child, man who died without his own kin, you see, was hopelessly. Think of the days where there was no printing. Think of the days where there was no writing. Think of the days where people, just nomads, went to the land. Do you think they were different from us? They had the same desire, but they had no sense that there was one eternity into which their deeds would be received and their words would be engraved into the hearts of men forever and forever. Now, naively as we may be today with regard to the great religious truth, every one of us is, I think, incompetent to embrace them completely. But this certainty we have, that we have some yardstick for time. This is the significance of the life of Christ in the four Gospels. The infinitely small, just one human life, they have become the yardstick for the whole eternity. What you do with millimeters today, and foot, and mile, in measuring space, you see, Christ has done for the computation of eternity. For what significance one single life can acquire for the whole history of mankind, which is the whole content of the doctrine, you see, about the Son. This is only, you see, there's a fabulous talent, you see, in all the professionals to hide the truth. It is very simple. It is just as discovering the yardstick of millimeters and foot in measurement space, which Jesus has performed. He made sure that the divine can appear in one life. Before, it had only appeared in the dynasties, you see, of thousands of years, in the building of the pyramids, in human sacrifices. If 10,000 people were sacrificed, they thought it was more divine than if you only sacrificed 5,000. And Pizarro, as you know, Pizarro was a hundred oxen. Who slaughtered 100 oxen? The Hecatomb, because he had discovered the Pythagorean problem. Don't you know? Well, you should know. Yeah. Well, all the sacrifices of antiquity, you see, were meant to affect the future. See, they are wrong means for a proper end. Until our Lord came into this world, the people were desperate how to measure time, how to impress the future, how to force upon the future, the grandchildren, that we had lived, that we left something behind us. And there's this tremendous peace that is higher than all reason today, since the cross, that even the humiliation, you see, the criminal punishment, can lead to fruit, if you accept it upon yourself. This is the only theologian, Donald Edwards, who has seen that the life of Christ, or the gospel truth, is adding to the nightmare of man, that he's lost in endless time, and means nothing in it, in the stream of time, you see, has added this clarity. It's not true. You mean something. You mean exactly what the amount of sacrifice you sacrifice into your love, you see, will come back on you and more. I don't know if I make myself clear. It is as simple as the relation of time and space. If you have a yardstick, you can read the inches, you see. If you have the life of Christ and eternity or the history of mankind, you have the yardstick, the inch, so to speak, the meter, by which you can measure the fruitfulness of human life. That was lacking before. There was no such thing, you see. All the nations tried to prove that for example, the Davidic kingdom, you see, came down now centuries. In 930, we assume David had lived. I think that's by and large a theory. No, it's a little earlier, 950. And that still the Davidic seed, you see, held together the prophecies given to the Jews, you see. Christ comes, and although they prove that he comes from the Davidic the family, it doesn't matter. I mean, this is not the reason why he is important, you see. He limits his effectiveness to this one short life. 3 years, perhaps, he had this open service in the country, you see. And yet, ever since, every human action is measured by this yardstick. As soon as a man doesn't measure his own actions and his enemy's actions by this yardstick, he has ceased to be a Christian. And therefore, of course, there are very people today are Christians who go to the church. I just received yesterday a letter by which a man told us that they had a monument in Germany made by a sculptor, which read from the Our Father, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive our trespasses, and then the days of the two world wars. And the town had ordered the monument, turned it down. That was too much for them. You see, you can pray this on Sunday at 11, but you cannot possibly have this as a monument that you really pray, you see, for forgiveness. and the town did not establish this monument, although you made the mess of Midas highly orthodox. And you would have turned against the two in your vote in the town assembly, because how can you, why should your town have confessed, you see, that you have sinned? You can personally confess it's much easier than to say that this good city of Santa Barbara has sinned. Nobody wants to say that. So it's very acute, this, but still the rumbling of his presence makes itself felt. The sculptor tried it on them, you see. They have, of course, the right to defeat him, but they will go down in history either as the town that turned this down, you see, or they will not be mentioned. So take your choice. You can be there as the evildoer, you see, in history, and get to enter history by this one resolution. It is very strange. Any real relation to the law makes history. Hitler is only interesting because of his anti-religious warfare, you see. The rest, mankind has always been so dirty. I mean, whether you are in the Congo and Germany, Germany was on the level of the Congo in the year of Hitler. But with regard of his religious hatred, you see, he is made, you see, it sort of became more. From this point on, we have to know about him, so that other will not fall into his trap. It's quite interesting, as you, for my friends, the secular historians, it's very hard going, you see, that they should admit that even under our noses, religious history has been happening. But Hitler is totally uninteresting this year, except for this reason, that he defied God. And he did. So, what I have tried to say is, I think my time is up, the only men who probably in this wilderness of New England, being all alone, having no newspapers, having no libraries even, you see, had to reduce the truth to the minimum, is this man Jonathan Edwards, by saying that the great thing of revelation, what we call revelation, is the condensation of God's efficaciousness in one life. That all the other stories told about God are of a larger nature, of an expanse through time of centuries. You speak of the Middle Ages, speak of the Renaissance, we say antiquity, you see, we say Jewish history, we have now American history, as far as it goes, and yet we may miss the kernel, because it isn't the length of the American history that makes it important, you see. The Declaration of Independence and Lincoln's Gettysburg Address are important, regardless of the length of the time through which the America has a story of its history of its own. Both, you only have to read them, take their clue from the gospel. They have learned it. That's the language of mankind which they have learned to speak there, and of which they have I always think the second inaugural is still better than the Gettysburg Address for this very reason, because it is, that is sublime. That appeals to what we know of men, you see, specifically. It doesn't begin 3 score and 10, but how does it begin? Does anybody know? The second inaugural. To me, that is the greatest piece in American prose I know. For this reason, that he quite naively puts himself in line with his language of the New Testament and goes on from there, continues it. When he says, you see, we do not yet know if we are not to be, if we have to give back every ounce which we have gained from the sweat of the slaves. And as you know, the bill is only presented at this moment. 100 years, the country has not made peace between South and North. We are still at war. Don't be betrayed. Don't be cheated. The same is true in Europe. If we speak of Cold War, you try to forget this war because you try to be against Russia. But Russia and America defeated Germany and Japan. And I assure you that this is the unrest. There hasn't been made any peace. And it has nothing to do with communism. Because that's, as I said, that's as dead as a dodo. again, as soon as you leave the paths of the Bible and of the Christian tradition, you lose all power to go beyond your day, your 24 hours of the Barbara Times or the Los Angeles Times. You see it. Most people have today a daily program of life. And so therefore they don't live at all. Because you cannot live 24 hours. And if you try to put together one 24 hours after another, you can add hundreds, you lose your life. Your life begins only if today and the day after tomorrow, you see, have a connection. And that doesn't matter. I mean, if a man from Japan came to this country, he must have memories from old, he must combine them with his life here, and he is a human being in as so far as he is able to do that. In so far as he lives, you see, this tin can life of mass media, he's not himself not alive, he's just dragged on, you see, as a tin can. And everyone, there comes my, you see, fury against seriousness and all play, you see, is of the moment. Now, I'm fully see, all seriousness is in the dark. You cannot talk to any young man of his real future, dreams of his own future, or you will destroy them. Let him play. But don't forget that while he is playing, something is growing in him, you see. And one day he will show off the shackles of his, the eggshells of his play, of his baseball, of his football, or his rowing, or his sailing, you see. And he will be somebody in his own right. And that takes time. And play gives us the time to outgrow the day. And this is a function of play. We must play so that the people cannot know what they want to do. This is our secret that is preserved in this manner. The more you play, you see, the less people know who you really are. At least it could be. I hope it will be in your case. My whole point today, pardon me for delaying you long, is this practical one. What I try to say about the economy of salvation is an economy of times. The economy of salvation means that the centuries, the ages, are interconnected, and that we bear fruit in centuries to come and are the fruit of centuries that have gone by. And the more we are aware of this simple fact that you are the heir of 5,000 years, lady, the more you live, and the less you admit this, the more you only want to wear the fashions of the day, the more old-fashioned you are. Because it is the old-fashioned who thinks he can live his own life outside this time measurement. And every one of you, by the way, if you have christened your child or sent your child to school or advise anybody about in his own in an illness, tries to treat him as a member of the eternity. You can't give a good advice without this notion, you see, that you must distinguish between appearances and the real thing. And you must sometimes give an advice, do this although it doesn't seem look good, you see. It has just to say, you have to do just the same. Not everything that is of eternal value looks good as of the moment. And I think every one of us has to make this distinction every day, that you cannot always please the marketplace. And it isn't how it looks on State Street that is important, you see. Oh, behind Goleta, so what's your main street here?
Hollister.
Oh, Hollister, yeah. Well, I think Hollister is misleading. I read these signs and very difficult to come to this university where you always are pushed into Hollister Avenue. That's the same relation between seriousness and play.
Any more questions for this?
Please. If you would begin to keep this in mind, that we need for the time exactly the same yardstick as you all use for space, you would wake up to the fact that time, our living in time, is itself the greatest human creation. It doesn't exist by itself.